Hi, I'm Carla Nappi, and this is New Books in East Asian Studies. Welcome. I just spoke with Kevin Gray Carr about his new book, Plotting the Prince, Shotoku Cults and the Mapping of Medieval Japanese Buddhism. This was published with the University of Hawaii Press in 2012. This book is of obvious interest to anyone working on art history, working on the history of Japan, working on the history of the medieval world and images in that context. But it's also, and perhaps surprisingly for listeners who don't, who haven't yet had a chance to read the book, a really interesting contribution to a much wider set of fields. And that's because of the thoughtfulness that Kevin brings to this topic and brings to the way he lays out the narrative and the argument of the book. Even the components that lay out the frame of the study, components like what does it mean to talk about a visual cult? What does cult mean in that context? Components like what does medieval mean in that context? Even those framing elements receive really careful exegesis in the course of the book, but also more deeply, kind of what's at the core of the methodology of the book and the core of the kind of argument that emerges out of the book is also presented in a way that takes apart the various components of this argument, presents it to readers in a detailed and thoughtful way, and really invites questioning of those elements, invites a thoughtful response to an engagement with those elements. And these elements include, what does it mean to talk about and to take apart the elements of an image as a visual narrative, as a story, and things like visual quotation, visual citation? What does it mean to talk about those processes, and how might a scholar go about isolating and identifying those in the service of creating a larger argument about shifting modes of identity and the way that narrative and images were bound up in that identity over time? Other elements of the argument that are really interesting and that will come up, as you'll hear in our conversation, include the idea of cognitive map and cognitive mapping, and really interestingly get at some of the problems and the opportunities related to what it might mean for a historian and for anyone working with the historical analysis of images to get at something like a cognitive map of people at a particular time, and to also be able to chart transformations in that cognitive mapping. So it's really interesting on a number of different levels. It was really interesting to talk with Kevin about it. He's extraordinarily thoughtful about all of these elements of the story that he's telling, and he really encourages engagement with him and with these elements of the book. And so I hope you enjoy. I certainly did. We're here today to talk with Kevin Gray Carr about his new book, Plotting the Prince, Shotoku Cults and the Mapping of Medieval Japanese Buddhism. Welcome to New Books in East Asian Studies, Kevin, and thank you for making the time to talk with me today.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So, Kevin, could you start us off by saying a little bit about your background? What brought you to the field of Japanese studies and perhaps religious studies and art history as it pertains to Japan in particular?
Yeah, it's a
it's a big question.
But in a sense, it's a long and boring story. But it started in high school. My parents told me I had to do some sort of sport. I was horrible at sports. I didn't want to run or play with balls or team sports. So it was swimming or martial arts, and I decided to take up martial arts. And through that, I became interested in Japanese culture. And through that, I became interested in Zen and kind of the beat Zen and DT Suzuki, that sort of thing. And then I got to college wanting to study Japanese, do Japanese studies, and the person they assigned me as an advisor was Sam Morris at Amherst, and he's an art historian, and he said, why don't you take my Arts of Asia class? I thought, oh gosh, no way I'm interested in that. But I humored him, and I took that class, and that same semester he was offering a class on Han art. The art of one period from one city in Japan. It is incredibly a specialized seminar for undergraduates. And of course, only one person signed up for it, and he needed three people to run the class. And so he got me and my roommate to do that. And so sort of by by default, I ended up taking a good amount of art history, Asian art history, in undergraduate, and that got me interested in Japanese art in general. But I spent my junior year in Kyoto, and when I left, I was interested either doing anthropology or religious studies. And what I realized when I was in Japan that year is that I could do religious studies and literature and history and all these other integrate all these other approaches through art history and spend all my time looking at beautiful pictures and traveling around the world. And I thought that's a great deal. And so I decided to go into apply for graduate school. I got very lucky to get into a great program, and then it just sort of led me on from there. But really, when I got to graduate school, I still didn't feel like an art historian. And it's in some ways, this book is a product of me feeling like becoming an art historian rather than a religious studies person who happened to work with official materials or general cultural history, things like that. So it's been an interesting sort of transformation over time as I've reconceptualized my own project and my own disciplinary approach.
So can you actually say a little bit more about that? Because part of the last bit of what you just said is actually really interesting. So you're drawing a distinction here between a real art historian and a religious studies scholar that happens to work with visual materials, for example. What are some of the important differences between those two approaches for you?
Well, real art historian is obviously a very loaded term, so I would probably try and take that back if I could. but there's a, when I arrived here, I was dual appointed in Asian languages and cultures and art history, and that seemed like a very natural fit for me. But what I realized is there's a certain set of issues that come from a common disciplinary and historiographical background that you have in art history that I wasn't finding in Asian studies. And what I love to my Asian studies colleagues and my colleagues at, say, the Center for Japanese Studies were working on a whole different set of issues. Often in Asian studies, it might be colonialism or nation building, things like that. Japanese studies, it might be something, you know, much more specific to the culture and the like. But what I found in art history, and this is partly a function of Michigan's very integrated art history department, is that I had as much to say to my colleagues in ancient archaeology as I did into modern architecture, to everyone in between. And they were questions often about the function of images, their ontological status, the sort of place within the world, how they work on people, how people create them, things like that. And so those made a lot of sense to me. But, you know, really through then probably even to the present day, I'm sort of a religious studies wannabe. I mean, most of my interests center around religious art. And part of that is that it's often visual material that's trying to deal with big questions, life and death and the place of one's place in the world. And it's often beautiful, but sometimes that just sort of pure aesthetic pleasure is secondary to its larger sort of payoff for the creators and the viewers. And it's those issues that excite me, especially. And, you know, I think of someone like Buzzy Tizer at Princeton, who very much uses a lot of visual material in his work, like the Ten Kings and the Wheel of Existence, things like that. But ultimately, he's interested in questions that are native to, I think, religious studies discipline. And I might work with the same material. And in fact, one of my colleagues worked on Ten Kings and was interested in a whole different set of questions about transmission of images and the meaning of the relationship of different media to each other, things like that. And so for me, it's not an either-or proposition. And there's times when I'm in one mode or the other. Like, for example, I wrote an article on Shotoku relics, which is for the Journal of Japanese Studies. And that's basically, as I see it, a religious studies foray with, you know, the visual argument is minimal, whereas other things I try to put the visual to the front. And I think what's the important... for me, the important thing is that, you know, we're all historians, so the history would be sort of the master discipline which we're contributing to. And there's textual historians, there's literary historians, there's religious historians. And as a art historian, my job is to treat the images well, because almost invariably, the conventional historians will read a lot more than me and better. Literary historians will have a much more subtle understanding of text and its functions. So what can I do in that process? And that's to work with images very actively. And what I like about that is they often... they don't tell the same story. In fact, when I was trying to teach, I was talking to one of my colleagues about teaching, doing a team talk course on medieval Japan. You know, she's a historian and I'm an art historian. And I'd say, oh, I have this great, you know, these great images of disease from the 12th century. And she says, oh yeah, I have some good material on disease from, you know, from 1483 or something like that. Totally different context. And they wouldn't match up. But what I tried to do in this book particularly is, look at very well-trod territory. I mean, there's, I haven't dared to count it, but there's probably 100 books on Shotoku belief, and maybe 50 books on Shotoku belief written in Japanese. And but they're almost all written from a textual standpoint. And so what happens if I try and tell that same story using images? And of course, I can't ignore the text, but thinking about what kind of contribution I can make and what kind of new insights I can offer, it's primarily going to be through a particular selection of a corpus of images and interpretation of that in a culturally specific way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So the book itself that we're talking about today looks at the figure of some of the you've mentioned, Prince Shotoku, about mm-hmm. whom we'll talk about later. And the focus of one of, this is, as you've kind of alluded to, the focus of one of the most widespread visual cults in Japanese history. Now, you're arguing in the book also that narrative art was a really powerful tool that helped people negotiate religious, political, and cultural identities, and really helped them make sense of their world and visual means. So how did you come to this figure and this topic in particular?
Well, you know, a good Shotoku believer would tell you that he came to him with a dream. Unfortunately, I didn't have a dream. I didn't have dreams about Shotoku until after I started this project, so I can't blame that. It was probably in my second year of graduate school. I took a seminar with my advisor on Yamato-e, which is sort of Japanese style painting. And one of the great early monuments of Yamato-e painting is the 1069 the images of Shotoku from 1069 at Horyuji Picture Hall that I talk about in the latter half of the book. And I did my final presentation and paper on that. But that was relatively early on, and I thought I wanted to do my dissertation on Shugendo, these mountain cults, and then everyone told me there's no good art about that. They were wrong, but I trusted them with that. Then I wanted to do it on Arhats, and someone said, and they told me that's too complex a topic, so I scuttled that. And Shotoku kept coming back. Once I sort of heard his name and started paying attention, he was everywhere, and especially once I dived into the subject. We'd be in class or we'd be in any conversation and I'd say, oh, Shotoku is related to that, or Shotoku did this, or Shotoku's here. And so I saw Shotoku everywhere. So I thought, you know, it's a good opportunity for my, one moment, please. Sorry about that. There's some bell in the background that that just rang. I don't know.
Oh, that's okay. We can just continue. It's cool. Okay. It's musical, like Muzak accompaniment.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, no worries.
So, in any event, Shotoku, I was seeing Shotoku everywhere, and I found this very exciting. And so I wanted to pursue this. And I had an interesting set of conversations with my advisors. Before I left for Japan to do my research, one of my advisors said to me, you know, keep it narrow, keep it focused. You know, basically, you have to finish this eventually is what he was trying to say, I think. And it was, you know, he was right. And, you know, I think it's good advice that I would, you know, give similar advice to my students. You know, don't try and do too much. But then I got to Japan and my advisor there said, if you're building a great house, you need to be build a very big, wide hole first. So dig deep and wide and essentially dig yourself in. And then, and I think both are good advice, and I don't really know how to resolve the two, but, you know, Shotoku really is such a sort of wide thing. But within that, I chose for my dissertation work to work on these medieval hanging scrolls of depicting his life. And that's it's a huge set of material, probably 50 sets from medieval Japan up through about like 17th century or so. And each of them might have anywhere from 1 to 10 scrolls within that, but that's still a limited set. But the range of Shotoku art is immense, and I mean, you could fill volumes upon volumes, and in fact, there are volumes of Shotoku art. So it was a good topic for me to be able to learn a little bit about the Zen sect or Shin sect or sculpture and painting and architecture and all these other things. And so once I sort of found Shotoku, it made a whole lot of sense to pursue it, because it was just a sort of great sprawling topic with implications in all sorts of different fields.
Now, what was the transition from dissertation to book like, if you could speak to that really briefly? Were there any major transformations in the narrative, any surprises along the way?
Yeah. well, I started, I mean, the dissertation is this, gosh, it's got to be over like 500 pages. I mean, it's just this big monster. And it's sort of an old style dissertation. And I've noticed that in recent years, it's much more common to have dissertations 250, 300 pages, much more lean dissertations. And they're much closer to what looks like a book already. So it's like they're a rough draft for a book. My advisor, for better or for worse, made it very clear that this is basically, I think this is his phrase, a personal letter to your advisor. And you would include everything. I mean, I love the pages in my dissertation where I had two lines of body text and the rest just footnotes, and next page would be the same. And, you know, that, and you have, you know, I probably had 50 pages of appendices and, you know, all these other things. And, you know, you can include any image you want. I for art historians, I mean, this is especially traumatic when I started to write the book, is to realize how few images I could use. But, you know, in a dissertation, I could just sort of go wild. And so the original manuscript I came up with when I converted my dissertation into a book manuscript was at least twice as long as what this book manuscript became. And they do what's called a manuscript workshop here at Michigan. It's a very generous thing where the senior faculty will get together and read all your material. They'll invite someone from another university to come. In this case, it was Mimi Yang, someone from Yale who came, and they read it and they gave me advice. And their advice was cut it in half. You have two books here. And the trouble was, the part that I really loved at that moment was the latter half, but it was speculative. There's a lot of jumps that I was making and a lot of methodological stretches that were probably pretty risky for a first book. So instead, I basically, as I said, I cut down most of that speculative material and really focused it on quite a narrow topic. So the first half of the book is a sort of overview of Shotoku cults seen through visual material. The second part is thinking about the origins of that, sort of what's the origins of medieval Shotoku, and I go to this 1069 set from Horyuji and focus basically the latter half of the book on that. And that's a much more, much smaller, or much more focused topic than the original. I think it's been a good process. I think that a lot of that material that was in the dissertation is lost to the ages. I mean, if someone wants to read the dissertation, they're more than welcome to. But I don't think that's ever going to be published in some journal or article or something like that. What I do have, it forced me to think hard about what was happening there. Why should anyone care about this obscure set of paintings from, you know, one temple in Japan? And so this is where I started to think about notions of cognitive mapping, about how people structure the world, and not just spatially but also temporally, and that really is fundamental to the Shotoku story, at least as I'm telling it.
Great, thank you. So as we move into the book itself, why don't we get started by really explaining who this figure is? So we've mentioned Shotoku, you've talked a little bit about the genesis of the project in terms of the extant literature. Who was the historical Shotoku, and what does that have to do with the historic or iconic, perhaps cultic figure that emerges in the course of the narrative that you're telling?
Well, Shotoku... I should preface this by, about the time I was in maybe my second year of writing this, a scholar in Japan named Oyama Seiichi wrote a book that said, argued that Shotoku did not exist. And this was actually not a lot of people don't know that, but it was not a new argument. This had, they had come up with this 40 years before, but it really hit the sort of mainstream media, and it was a very big deal. And it was part of a larger movement within Japanese studies, Japanese history, to sort of rethink Japanese history and kind of pull down some of the idols. And Shotoku would be one of the most sort of iconic figures in that. But I'm pretty sure he existed, or something like him existed. And, you know, if the dates we have is 574 to 622 or 623, around that time. So he's a 6th and 7th century figure. But the earliest texts we have about him are things like the Nihon Shoki from the early 8th century. So what I found interesting about him is, from the start, we're talking about a distance of about 100 years where he's already been recreated. And there's a strong strong possibility that a lot of what's attributed to him was really done by Suiko, who is his aunt, and she was the empress at the time. But because of later conceptions of female sovereigns, they took a lot of that away and sort of made Shotoku as the regent, the main sort of mover of that time. So there's a great deal of interesting work done and to be done on the so-called real Shotoku. And I'd refer your listeners to a book like Michael Como's book on Shotoku. And that's much more interested in the historical time of the real Shotoku from the 7th century. But actually, when I heard that this prominent scholar was arguing Shotoku didn't exist, I was initially disturbed, and I thought, that's great. You know, in a sense, I'm writing this story about sort of this empty center, and I think I even refer to him in the book somewhere as a sort of cipher into which people can, you know, pour in all their different ideas and hopes and dreams. And so from the 8th century on, he's already this sort of imaginary figure. But it's always couched in the language of history. And, I have some passages in the book, and there's more in the dissertation about, you know, people really thought of this as history. You know, I struggle with the word legend, because, you know, legend implies that we already know that's not true, or there's some, that it's something different from history. But most all of the medieval writers on Shotoku were writing history, or writing what they thought of as the factual real story. And I think that keeping that in mind is important for, one, understanding that whether or not Shotoku existed, people thought he existed, and this imaginary figure had a huge influence on Japanese cultural history. That's, you know, and if an actual figure didn't exist, that's a great story. And also, he's constantly shifting. But one of the things I suggest in the book is that the sort of hagiographic process is not one of argumentation and removal. So it's not someone's the Tendai sect says Shotoku was a lotus adherent, and he wrote this great lotus commentary. And then the Zen sect will come along and say, no, he didn't. He wasn't interested in the lotus. He was interested in Zen, and he was a good friend of Bodhidharma, and we can tell that story. Now, those seem like they're contradictory stories, but instead what you get is this agglutinative biography that you just keep adding things on to Shotoku. And so the next group that comes along and wants to lay claim to Shotoku's authority, they'll draw some specific connection to themselves, whether it be material or historical things like, or legendary sort of stories that they'll tell. But then they'll also be tapping into all those other connections, and so it's this increasingly sprawling, difficult figure. And so by I very much cut off the story before, say, about 1600, when even more layers are added to Shotoku, and of course in the 20th century, Shotoku becomes tied up with the politics of East Asian expansion of the of Japan during World War II. And in fact, one of the challenges I faced is a lot of the temples, especially the Pure Land temples that I visited, were embarrassed about their Shotoku, the Shotoku connections, because during the war, people would be asked, who do you most admire? And the only answer you'd come, you were able to say would be the emperor, of course. But Pure Land adherents didn't necessarily feel that way. But one of the answers they could give that was considered acceptable was Shotoku. And Shotoku was considered one of their patriarchs, but he was also a patriarch of the Japanese nation state, as it was conceived of in that time. And so the temples brought out their Shotoku images and said, isn't this great? We have this long-standing connection with the imperial family. And then after the war, they said, oh, well, that was kind of embarrassing. And they put them in the back of their storage houses and really tried to suppress some of that. And so I would often go to these places where the paintings or the sculptures were in disrepair or sort of pushed off to the side because of this more recent history. So he said, each of those sort of iterations didn't necessarily negate what came before, just added and added to this this hulking sort of cultural phenomenon.
And I think at one point in the book, when you're talking about this additive nature of, or creative nature of the histories of Shotoku, you actually mentioned that perhaps archaeology is a better metaphor for understanding how to get at these different layers than, you know, what we typically think of as chronological history.
I think it's, part of that is my wider interest in archaeological theory, but the I think certainly it felt like trying to peel layers back. And of course, I'm interested in what Shotoku was in the 7th century, the 8th century, the 9th century, things like that. But, in order to look at any piece, I sort of have to, feel like I'd be pulling back one layer and see another thing and another thing, and then be just sort of going deeper and deeper and deeper into this sort of always shifting core. And it was, that's an exciting, exciting and disturbing thing for a researcher to try to pursue, because it always seems to be one more step that you don't have access to. And ultimately, we don't know who Shotoku was or even if he existed. And that's, I think, one of the thrilling things about his story, basically.
Now, one of the things that you're getting at in these comments is you're getting at, on some level, the at least what this reader perceived to be the centrality of different ways of thinking about identity in the book. And that's not just the identity of this figure, but also the identity of the creators and audiences for these images, and ultimately the identity of Japan as a unit and as a concept. Now, you get here and you get to that point by giving us what you describe at the beginning of the book as a case study in the development of cognitive maps of the world. And these maps that were developed through storytelling, visual storytelling, actually in really interesting ways that I hope we'll get to later on in the conversation, that imagined this figure, this cultural hero that was grounded in really distinct forms of space. So can you talk a little bit about this idea of the cognitive map? In what way does this structure the kind of argument that you're telling, and why was this particular concept so central for helping you think through and narrating the story of Shotoku in this larger context?
That's a good question. I think you asked earlier about the transition from dissertation to book. I'll have to look back. I'm almost certain I didn't use any term like that in my original dissertation work. And, sometimes I'm frustrated by reading, especially first books, where, here's someone who's worked for a decade on some topic, and they finally come out with this book, and it's been gutted in some way, and then they add some sort of theoretical what seems like a theoretical afterthought to it that isn't really inherent to the material. And that perhaps would be something I think that would seem to be the case in here, that I've just sort of added this cognitive map idea. But what I realized is that's really what I was getting at, or was pursuing through the whole thing. And especially if you can widen your concept think of a map both as a spatial and temporal thing, and so thinking about how people in Japan, say medieval Japan, are situating themselves in relationship to continental authority, but also the sort of temporal distance from, say, Shakyamuni or Chinese masters. And the other is, I think, my opening quote, I think, in my beginning of the introduction is about to read a map is to tell a story. So looking at a map is a kind of story. And so this, it's a, the notion of a map is perhaps a real cartographer really be really annoyed by using it so broadly, but I'm thinking of these maps, both cognitive, like in people's heads and as they're manifest in visual images, that they are structuring one's temporal and spatial relationship to the world, and they're a kind of story, and the story is mapped onto that. And that's, you know, it's sort of a plotting title, but Plotting the Prince is getting exactly at that. Plotting both as, you know, you plot on a map, you decide a certain point on a map, but also in plotting, you know, telling a story. And I think both of those are at play here. What I didn't realize when I came up with this term cognitive map was that it actually has a very eminent background with Jameson. You know, completely forgot that he mentioned that at the end of his famous essay on what the cultural logic of, you know, capitalism. And and I realized that I had to, and I talk about this a little bit in the introduction, I had to sort of disentangle it from that. But in a lot of ways, it's the same sort of idea. It's trying to represent something that's ultimately unrepresentable, I think. And so here's people who are looking at these images, hearing these stories, and trying to figure out their place within the Buddhist universe, how they relate to what it means to be this country. It's often described, Japan is often described as one of the millet scattered countries. Millet is this little grain that you just sort of throw out. You imagine it sort of thrown out onto the waves and just sort of floating out on the waves. And if you look at even some maps for Japan of the world, Japan is just this little sort of afterthought on the edge of the universe. And so what does it mean to be in that position? Well, ultimately what I argue in the book is that Shotoku is one means by which they can say that not only do we have access to those sources of power in the past and the distant, physically distant and temporally distant past in, say, Shakyamuni through Shotoku and his previous lives and his connections, but it more radically, it doesn't matter. We don't need all those things. In fact, the new center of Buddhism is in Japan itself. And so you get this wonderful sort of notion that at Shitennoji, one of the temples associated with Shotoku, that Gurdjieffukuta, the vulture peak, uprooted itself and flew to Japan and, you know, plopped itself down there. So we don't need to go to India because we have it all here. And this is what I was talking about, sort of the recentering of the world. And so this this notion of a cognitive map is the way that is trying to get at the way that these images and stories and the ritual context can reshape people's view of the world so that they see them, they replot the world. So they see themselves perhaps at the center rather than the periphery, that time begins with Shotoku rather in the sort of key authoritative time begins with Shotoku rather than with Shakyamuni. And those new conceptions, those new cognitive maps that lodge in people's brains, then affect the way that they see other art, they read other texts, they engage with other people. That process where that map is created and then exported or becomes a filter for understanding the world as a whole.
Thank you. And as we work through the book, you start us off at the beginning of the book, laying out three major elements of these cognitive maps of Shochaku's life that are going to come up in different ways for the remainder of the analysis. Mm-hmm. Each of these is actually linked to a particular kind of medium that also you're going to take us through and explain the importance of. So you've already kind of alluded to this, but these three elements that you lay out here are place, and this is linked to cartography, both in the form of a landscape and in the form of a map, time, which is linked to narrative painting, which is going to become really important, especially in the second half of the book, and also person, and this is linked to iconic portraiture. Now, as we move through the parts of the book, there are two parts of the book in particular. Mm-hmm. Part one really takes on this issue that we kind of alluded to before, which is the issue of changing identities mm-hmm. of Shochaku over time. And this is true in a number of different ways, and it takes a number of different forms. It talks about not only something that you kind of mentioned before, the way that Shochaku became associated with other religious figures like Shakyamuni, but also the ways in which this figure becomes one that simultaneously can move around and exist kind of every place, mm-hmm. but winds up really interestingly taking on a very particular Japanese identity mm-hmm. and Japanese import. So can you talk a little bit to that? Because the first chapters of the book really emphasize these dual, really interesting, but interestingly mutually constitutive aspects of Shochaku's identity. On the one hand, this sort of changing manifestation in different visual and written media as a bodhisattva, as a person who passes through multiple lives, some of them being in China, but at the same time, ultimately turning out to be, in this period, a uniquely Japanese figure. What does that mean, and how are those two aspects of Shochaku reconciled with respect to these visual sources that we have?
Well, it's a key question, I think, and I appreciate you formulating it that way. I think that Shochaku, well, any religious figure, especially, say, I'll just speak within, say, East Asian Buddhism, that a promoter, a creator of that figure needs to figure out a balance between the sort of transcendent and the local. So you have an image of an arhat, you know, some Buddhist saint. If he looks too strange, then it's very hard to relate to, and it doesn't seem like a viable model for your own practice, or it doesn't seem like someone who would care about your concerns. But if it's too familiar looking, it would look like just, you know, Joe Schmo, what would be the Buddhist equivalent of that, Joe Schmo monk from down the street, that, you know, doesn't look like anything special. And so there's that pull back and forth that I think you have in almost any sort of religious depiction of a religious figure, between the sort of transcendent and the accessible and local. And certainly within, say, sculptural history, at least in Japan, you see that, you see those poles go, you see a transfer between those poles constantly. In the case of Shotoku specifically, because he's used over time, there's early on, Shotoku is, and I think I characterize it this way, as a bridge. He's someone who gives us access to all these other figures, like Bodhidharma, like Hui Si, the Chinese sage teacher of Juri, people like Shakyamuni and the like. So if we connect ourselves to Shotoku, then we have that link to those other ones. But then you see sort of his post biographies that he gets reborn as all these other people, like Kukai, for example, and he has these sort of constant sort of reproductions or recorporalizations that you have, and that's a way that links this incredible sort of range of sacred authority in this one figure. But then I started to think, well, wait a minute, what does this mean? And it's a kind of question, you know, to ask, you know, what is reborn is a sort of first year Buddhism type question. So, you know, I think a you know, hardcore religious studies person would say that's, you know, well, of course they, you know, they don't really take no self seriously, or that that it doesn't quite work that way. But you know what I found in medieval texts is people saying, you know, using the notion of non-self and thinking about rebirth and, you know, what is Shotoku, that that was actually something at the time that was important to them. And so this identity of Shotoku, because if there's not some sort of constant identity that carries through all his different lives as Lady Shimala, as Weisu, Shotoku, and beyond, then those connections are sort of arbitrary. They don't mean much. And so there has to be some sort of core that links that. And I don't think I solved that issue, but really what I was trying to do is just point it out as an issue. And I think what you eventually get is a way that Shotoku is a core identity that is a sort of core figure, the actual Prince Shotoku, sort of thinking of the 8th century figure, is a core identity that becomes... sort of truly transcendent. His biography goes essentially unlimited directions in both directions from Shakyamuni up to the present day. But if he just remains that, he's no different, say, from Kanmon Bodhisattva, like Guan Yin, any other Bodhisattva that sort of it can be everywhere and everything to everyone. And so what really makes him special is that it's no doubt, it's very clear that he's completely Japanese, that he's born in Japan. He's particularly interested in, he's the founder, considered the founder of Japanese Buddhism, but also in many ways the founder of the Japanese state. He establishes all these Chinese style court ranks and he entertains all these embassies from the Korean Peninsula and from China. And really he's at this sort of beginning, not only of sort of Japanese religious identity, but sort of state identity. And I think that's a very interesting position to be in. And then people, and I suggested that, you know, he doesn't have much to do with the kami tradition, with what we think of as sort of Shinto, broadly conceived. But he is sort of an ancestor to everyone, because his line, at least according to legend, was completely wiped out in 643. So he doesn't... His descendants don't exist anymore. His blood descendants don't exist anymore. But because of that, then he's sort of open season for anyone to claim. And everyone does claim him as sort of being their Shotoku. And so it's this... you get the same ambiguity between the transcendent and local in Shotoku, but his local identity means a great deal, because he then becomes the source for some sort of notion of Japanese-ness in early medieval Japan. And that's, in a sense, the subject of my next book, is trying to really unpack what people are talking about when they're talking about, and there's lots of Japanese terms for this, but Japan or the Japanese country or nation or something like that, nation probably the wrong word, but when they're talking about that in, say, the 12th, 13th, 14th century, and oftentimes they're using Shotoku as a way to talk about that sort of particularly unique identity.
Yeah, and I think you actually say in the book at one point that it's not only that the stories of his life are taking place in Japan, but also you can read the story of his life as the story of Japan in relation to a larger world context that it's part of.
And importantly, you can go to the sites associated with him. You can see these places. And so at Honyuji, very definitely, you're right there where a lot of this happened. But then when you take those off the walls and they become sort of portable hanging scrolls, someone off in the provinces can either imagine going to these places, and it's familiar landscapes and the like that is at least possible to go to. But also, at least one of the things I argue is that, and this starts at Horyuji, but I think it happens in many other cases, is that telling the story of Shotoku is a way to reconstitute him as an object of iconic worship. And so, you know, I have this ugly phrase, the icon narrative, a combined icon and narrative, and it's... it's sort of clunky, but it gets exactly at what I'm talking about. These objects that are narrative in form, but they function ritually as iconic images. And so you get these sets of paintings depicting Shotoku's life, which are extremely extensive. If you told the whole story, it would take hours and hours, and sometimes been to modern rituals where it takes days. But that then, those stories are kind of they by telling that story, you create a kind of person, and then this is the relationship what I was talking about between place and person and time and all that sort of thing coming together in a ritual context, and it's also an unstable combination because all these as I mentioned in the epilogue, all these sort of pieces are hard to hold together, and especially for an artist trying to integrate them fully, it's quite a challenge, and even and you can see from my analysis of the paintings of Hōryūji that even that doesn't fully succeed, that it's sort of, there's a lot of sort of strange matches and ambiguities. And so Shōtoku is this very fertile core, but it's also, let me get this right, centrifugal, that, the pieces of him, these sort of different aspects of the time and place and person sort of fall off. So you get portraits of Shōtoku, you get straight maps of sacred sites, you have hand scrolls of his narrative, things like that, and those become more prominent over time.
I mean, let's actually move to these visual narratives specifically, because this is what the second half of the book is all about. Now, but before I mention that, I think in saying that the story of this particular really extreme case is particularly difficult because the pieces don't hold together, I think one of the things you might be doing here is actually quite profound. I mean, you might be giving us an extreme case that winds up proving the rule, which is, I think if we looked more broadly at any kind of object or identity, we might, using this example and moving from this example, also see really anything, even those things that seem like they are kind of the most coherent, also turning out to be pieces uneasily held together to form part of a kind of shifting whole. So I think this is actually perhaps not, one of the kind of problematic issues in the kind of story that's being told here, but perhaps one of the most profound contributions of the book. So we'll get there.
I'm glad you point that out, because that's in many ways what I am trying to get at in Shōtoku. I mean, Shōtoku seems like a very specific topic to approach, but part of my reason for choosing him and for making a shorter book that might be less expensive and more accessible to more people is to sort of paint a picture of a paradigm of, in this case, sacred identity, and impliedly, hopefully inspire some people to think of a whole range of different identities, not only sort of individual identities, like basically the story of a famous monk or something like that, but also collective identities. And that's something that I've been thinking about more recently, about how a community starts to think of themselves form a picture of themselves, again, a sort of cognitive map about where they are situated in the world. And I think that's I think this is where, again, a looking at the visual material is a good approach, because certainly for medieval sects that were trying to promote promote their particular institution, images were great because they could, other than the expense, they could unify a lot of people. So you and I might look at the same image or hear the same, experience the same ritual and be picking up on different things, but then feel very, both feel this sort of sense of emotion, and the other person seems to be feeling the same emotion. So we can be unified in the way that perhaps a sort of pure discursive text might not, or might not allow us that ambiguity. But it's also that precisely that ambiguity that was a problem, because if you were trying to maintain an orthodoxy and maintain a sort of a cleanliness to that, clean borders and a specificity to that identity, it's very hard with visual art because it isn't so straightforward, and it has these different aspects of it. And so I think that's something that I'm certainly wanting to pursue in my subsequent work.
Right. And even though these are not explicitly sort of verbal discursive sources, you are showing quite explicitly, I think, in the book that there is a kind of discourse in these visual sources, and you use phrases like visual assertion, visual quotation, visual statements. So let's actually, I don't want to let you go before talking a little bit about this main set of paintings that really occupies most of the second half of the book. So part two of the book looks at the functions of this cultic art around Shotoku by looking at the Japanese religious landscape as it's manifest in two, but one in particular, sort of sources of visual culture. One is the now lost 8th century, a set of images that are now lost from the 8th century. But the one that really receives most of the attention in the book is this set of Horyuji picture hall images that you've been mentioning that were made in 1069. Now, because this is, again, such a central part of the close analysis that happens in the second half of the book, it's such an important part of the source base around which we're developing this argument. Can you speak a little bit about these sources? Can you talk about what is this compound in the structure of the compound, and how would a viewer in particular, because this is really important, looking at these paintings have experienced the paintings?
Mm-hmm. It's a great question. You know, it's a lot of what drove my initial dissertation research was wanting to answer a question that I pretty much knew was unanswerable, and that is, how did people use these, and what did that do to them? How did that affect them? And it's really, really hard to get at that because there's, and, you know, I was looking at a whole range of these large hanging scrolls, but there's almost never a text that says, you know, Bob and Jean and Bill and I went to this ritual at such and such a temple. This person was speaking and these other people were there. They said this about the images. The images look like this, and you know, was and this is how we felt. Nothing even near like that. But the nice thing about Shotoku is that, and you know, you can refer to Ikumi Kaminishi's book, called A Toki Japanese Story. Pictorial exegesis, but it's called Etoki, E-T-O-K-I, and she talks about these ritual exegesis of pictures, and that really excited me because a lot of that, the early material, and you can find that, I think, chapter two of her book, a lot of that material, it comes from Shotoku stories, so we actually know a lot more about how these images were used. Part of the reason why I wanted to work on these particular images is they're real. It's almost you know, they've been repainted so much. There's it's really hard to say anything intelligent about their style and things like that. But that's primarily how people have treated them, as sort of 11th century what 11th century painting looks like. And the one thing that I think hasn't changed over all the centuries and the different changes is the composition. And so what does that composition? What does that sort of layout? What does that layout mean? In order to understand that, you have to understand its architectural space, and that's part of the reason why I have these some of these diagrams where you kind of have a U shape to the image to give you some sense of how this is at least a half a semi panorama. And then, so in a particular architectural space, and that architectural space is really quite fascinating because it's this dual hall. So on one side you have the picture hall, and on the other side you have the relic hall. And so just in terms of the architecture, there's some equivalency being made between relics and narrative painting, which is, I think, a really important important point. And then if you take a step farther out, this is in the eastern precinct of Horyuji, this famous temple, supposedly where on the site of Shotoku's original palace, mansion, and you have a dual structure in that temple. So you have the western precinct and the eastern precinct. The western precinct looks like the kind of temple you might expect to see in a lot of places in, you know, Korea or China, things like that. And it has a pagoda, it has a golden hall, it has a lecture hall, and it has also the parts, and, you know, there are different configurations, but it has all of the basic parts of a conventional Buddhist temple in East Asia, you know, in the, 7th century. But the Eastern Precinct is dedicated to Shotoku, and it started, you know, about 100 years after Shotoku's birth, and it's really and at the center of it is this Dream Hall, this octagonal hall, supposedly where Shotoku would go into sort of his meditations, and he'd fly to China, things like that. And then right up to this, right on its main axis, is this image hall and relic hall. And so it's a part of the reason why this, or I think this is an interesting piece. One, it's age. You know, it's one of the sort of earliest paintings of this sort of the scale and style that we have, but also that it really shows a very different conception of sacred imagery, sacred presence, than what you see in the Western precinct and in general and sort of standard, you know, Buddhist temple layouts. And so there's something very different going on, and it involves sculpture and painting and architecture and ritual, and all of that we have at least some access to as historians. And so that's an exciting payoff for people who'd want to try to understand how art might function at a specific time in, say, the 11th century, but then how it continues to function over time.
Now, and in the final chapter of the book before the epilogue, in the course of describing these paintings and talking about their significance, you describe what you're doing in this chapter as a kind of or a story of a conceptual remapping that happens in the 13th and 14th centuries. And you state here that in this period, a mature cognitive map of Japan with multiple sacred centers reliant on sources of religious authority that weren't from the continent, but that also weren't from Japanese capitals, emerged. This is a large and it's an important argument that you're making here. Can you explain how Shotoku gives you access to this kind of argument? So what is Shotoku and this figure and the iconography of this picture, of this figure, or rather the visual narratives that are inherent in this particular site about this figure? How does this lead to this kind of dramatic conceptual remapping? Or conversely, how does this kind of dramatic conceptual remapping, how is that reflected in images of Shotoku and his life or lives?
Mm-hmm. Well, some of it is, you know, the kind of visual argument that you were talking about, as using terms like visual rhetoric, visual argument, that would seem, I think, kind of loopy to someone outside of art history or not terribly sympathetic to it. For example, I have a image of Shitennoji Temple, and then there's a torii gate, sort of a Shinto-style gate, and then Mount Fuji. And I argue that because of the particular layout of that, it implies that it gets complex, but it implies that Fuji is a kind of pure land, and just because of the way it's set up. Now, that's a visual argument being made that's may not have been explicit at the time, but I think actually carries through. Another one, I argue about Shotoku, being flying up right above his grave and things, implications like that. So there's things you could draw from the images to try and understand sort of how they might be reconceptualizing the world. But specifically with the 11th century images, these are, unlike most of the Shotoku art that I recount in the book, this is in a specific place, fixed wall paintings, basically. They're on silk, but they're fixed like as panels on the wall. And so there's only one place in the world that it makes sense to look at these. They're now in Tokyo, so it sort of takes us out of that. But what I suggest is this is kind of window. I think I even use the word sacred panopticon, where you're looking out onto this space, and it shows you, and this gets back to in the direction where I talk about the really real and the world as it appears. This sort of gives you a view of the world, just like when you go up to the top of the Empire State Building, there's or a place like that, there'd often be like a photograph of the same view, and then it'll point out to you which is, you know, this is, such and such a bridge, and this is the river, that sort of thing. And you can sort of see the world that way. So that it functions in a very specific way at a very specific moment. And so what that does, and partly because it's the genius of the creators and the particular moment, that it allows you to see this vision of the sacred world. And at this, in the core center is where you're standing right there. So that's a pretty powerful vision. But then what happens is when not every the latter history of Shotoku cult, especially by the say 13th century, is primarily not at centers like Horyuji, the sort of traditional centers of Shotoku belief, but off in the provinces. So like way off in northeastern Japan, for example, sort of near present day Tokyo, places like that. And those places have no direct physical connection to Shotoku, but then this creates this problem of having this connection back to Shotoku. But you then find ways that they will try to recenter themselves and say, oh, Shotoku came here, and this such and such a miracle happened. And if you're interested, go to that rock, and you'll see that there's a hole in that, and that's where the water came out when Shotoku struck it with his staff or something like that. And things like that, then this is what I mean by these multiple centers. And so it's... the concept that we haven't mentioned that I think is fundamental to this story that I should bring up is the latter days of the law or the latter days of the Dharma, the Mappo. This is, a concept that, of course, originated in China, but according to at least one calculation, it started in 552, and there's different dates for when Buddhism came to Japan, but one of the dates for when Buddhism supposedly officially came to Japan is 552. And, most later commentators said it was 1052, but what it's saying, either if it's 552, it's saying at the very beginning of Buddhism in Japan, it's the end. It's sort of the beginning of a degenerate age. And 1052 sort of said, we're really sure we're in this degenerate age. And so what you have is this sort of beginning of this medieval paradigm really is responding to this notion that we're impossibly distant from the time of Shakyamuni and the place, thousands of miles, thousands of kilometers away and thousands of years away. And so you have this real problem. Like, what's the point of any of our practice if we don't have that connection, if basically the world is falling apart? And Shotoku allows people to say that, one, someone who knew the Buddha is right here. We can connect to him in some way, whether we connect to him in his sort of physical presence and his the markers of where the marks he left on the Japanese landscape, or we can connect to him through story by telling this story and that recreates him, or his subsequent lives. We can meet Shotoku in some way, some concrete way. So there's that that connection there that that negates some of that. But even more profoundly, it may be a degenerate age in China or India. Buddhism may have disappeared completely from there. But, and multiple medieval thinkers argue this. They say that actually Japan is this is the last bastion, is the last sort of the great shining light. And we can then sort of we have the exclusive connection to the real Buddhist truth. And then that means that a certain conceptual map of the world then puts Japan at the center. And then within Japan, different sites will compete to say, who's really sort of the source of this authority and who, is basically just a sort of shadow of this degenerate age. Does that make some sense?
Absolutely. Well, Kevin, we've taken up a lot of your time, and thank you so much for being such a great insight into the book. It's a wonderful book. Is there anything in particular that we didn't have a chance to get to but that you want to mention for listeners? And I should preface that for listeners by saying there's a ton of material in the book that we didn't talk about. So definitely go and read the book because it's extraordinarily rich. There's all kinds of really wonderful close readings and also really kind of a model for how we might read images as narrative that I think is extraordinarily useful for anybody, regardless of whether or not you work on Japan. But is there anything in particular that you want to mention for listeners that we may not have covered?
I don't think so. I mean, I think... I think the question of identity is something that you brought up, and I don't think is fully resolved, certainly in my mind or in this book. And it's something that I hope that notions of identity, and questions of even this, the usefulness of a concept like cognitive map. I can imagine ways that, certainly within the Japanese context, but in a lot of different contexts, that it might be useful. But I really hope is that a book like this at the very least, annoys a lot of people. And they know it doesn't quite work that way. But they can articulate why, and it could be sort of a source for further discussion. I mean, I think one of the exciting things about this, I mentioned people like Michael Como and Ikumi Kaminishi. There's lots of other scholars who are working on, say, Shotoku, and working on similar issues of mapping, things like that. Max Merman is working on Buddhist maps from the Edo period, for example, that these are great opportunities, I think, for us to really engage with each other and disagree and challenge each other and have this conversation. So I hope this book is something that will be a goad to further conversations among scholars, and I hope people will feel free to contact me too.
So Kevin, now that the book is out, and again, congratulations on the book being out, what's next for you? What project is currently inspiring you?
Oh, too much is inspiring me. There's two main lines that I'm working in. One is something that I haven't quite decided if it's going to be just end with this one article or it's going to be on. But in a fresher volume from my advisor, Professor Shimizu, is called Crossing the Sea. In that, I have an essay on what I call the epistemology of art. And I've been interested in, I've spent so much time sort of within the medieval Japanese context that when I read the story of some miracle, I just sort of take it for granted. I say, oh, of course, the statue got up and walked around and like, and, a couple years ago, I started thinking, wait a minute, that's kind of crazy. Why would anyone believe that? And so I've been trying to think of how, trying to consider ways that art, creates belief and why people believe astounding things based on visual arts and how that sort of serves as evidence. And this is something that I think may be a much larger project I'd like to pursue. But more approximately, what I've been working on most lately is what are called engie. And engie are sort of miraculous origin stories. And so paintings of miraculous origin stories usually have a temple or a shrine. And it involves usually some sacred icon and the stories that go with it and some sacred person, like some monk or nun who founds the place. And in many ways, it's an extension of what I've been doing in this book. I'm still interested in mapping. In fact, I have a whole chapter on national maps. And I'm especially interested in this notion of identity because I'm suggesting that these stories become important seeds for people's sense of belonging to a certain place. And then those tied to multiple sort of stories like that tied together are the seed for regional identity and eventually some identification with a notion of Japan. There's all sorts of ways this is spoken of in the contemporary literature. I'm primarily interested in the 14th century, but so I'm looking at how this, basically how the biography of places, and so still working with some of these same, idea of person, place, and narrative, but how the biography of places are a seed for local identities and eventually sort of a much more national level identity.
Well, best of luck with that set of projects, Kevin, and thank you again so much for making the time to talk today.
Well, it's wonderful to talk to you, and I look forward to any comments that people have, so thank you.
Hi there, you've been listening to New Books in East Asian Studies. Thanks so much for joining us, and we'll see you next time.